Brought to you by the Capital One Venture X Card. Earn unlimited 2x miles on everything you buy and turn everyday purchases into extraordinary trips. Plus, receive premium travel benefits like access to over 1,300 airport lounges and a $300 annual credit for bookings through Capital One Travel. Unlock a whole new world of travel with the Capital One Venture X Card. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Lounge access is subject to change. See CapitalOne.com for details. Hey there, everybody. Here's some bonus stuff you should know. This time it's about traveling to Orlando for business. Orlando has tons of places to host your conferences and meetings. Dr. Michael Edwards, CEO of Ocean Insight, said it best. Orlando is as much a business capital as an entertainment one. And when the day is done, you can kick off each evening at one of 46 Michelin-rated restaurants. What's not to love? So check out Orlando, where the possibilities for business travel are unbelievably real. Learn more at OrlandoForBusiness.com.
Welcome to Stuff You Should Know, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Josh Clark. There's Charles W. Chuck Bryan over there, and Jerry's even here, which means this is a bona fide, bona fide, shut your mouth episode of Stuff You Should Know.
Right, until Jerry's like, we gotta go.
I wasn't going to out her like that, but you did, so she'll probably end up being sore at me about it, though.
We're all busy these days.
Seriously, life, man. Life times 100, right?
Yeah, I mean, 13 years in, and we're still working out technical difficulties.
I know. I know. But we're working it out. We're working it out, Chuck, like a brilliant scientist, one of my all-time favorites, and a frequent guest star of the show in the early years, Paul Broca.
Yeah, it's been a while, huh?
Yeah, like he worked out a little puzzle that he had handed to him almost literally in the 1870s.
That's right. This is one of those where I was positive we had covered it before.
Oh, really? No, I knew for a fact we hadn't, and I'll explain why in a minute.
It had to be on an internet roundup or something.
I don't think so, man.
I know we talked about the movie Pi when he drilled a hole in his head.
Oh, I forgot about that.
I just can't remember what episode or what format it was.
Maybe you're right. Maybe it was an internet roundup because I could see us talking about that internet group doing that kind of stuff, the International Trepanation Advocacy Group, I'll bet.
I even went to our Wikipedia page because they have a place where they list things that we've redone.
Oh, yeah. I didn't see that.
Yeah. And by the way, I wanted to put out a call. If you are a Wikipedia editor, our page is years and years and years out of date. Yeah. It says that we're writers for How Stuff Works. We haven't written for them in, what, like 8 years?
It's been a little while, yeah.
So if anyone wants to update it, it's got... I mean, God bless her. I miss Rebecca, but it said that Rebecca is our web publisher.
Right.
That's a long time ago.
Yeah, it has been a little while.
So anyway, if anyone feels like blowing the dust off of that thing,
well,
feel free.
Okay, so, well, that was a great call out, Chuck, but let's get back to trepanation, okay? And like you said before we started recording.
Oh, no.
Chuck said he has no trepidation about trepanation.
That was for your ears.
That was great, though. It was definitely worth sharing.
Terrible.
But so maybe I mentioned it before then, because I always associate trepanation with this little second, 1 second long snippet from those Time Life Mysteries of the Unknown book ads from the, like, 1990. And there's like one moment where they like show somebody like doing a trepanation surgery on somebody else's head in like a cave by torchlight.
I think I remember that.
Yeah. And I was like, wait, what is that? I want to know more about that. So this has been sitting in our back pocket all this time. And I guess we busted it out at least once before. It had to have been Internet Roundup. It definitely wasn't an episode.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. But unless we talked about it during lobotomies, I don't know.
It could have been. It could have been, Chuck, because a lot of people say, well, yeah, the lobotomy was the natural progression to... trepanation.
But not really.
No, it's actually, that's incredibly false. It turns out trepanation is maybe one of the oldest medical techniques, if not the oldest medical technique we have, aside from like slapping someone on the back when they're choking. That might be older.
But we don't have any evidence to back that up. We actually have the evidence from trepanation. And to get back to Monsieur Broca, famous for the Broca's area, which is the first region of the brain that demonstrated localized function, like the speech center is it produces speech. And it's the first time we could ever say this part of the brain is responsible for this function. And Broca was the guy who did that. He had a skull handed to him in the 1870s, and it turned out to be an Incan skull. I couldn't find out anywhere how old it was. But we can guess that by the time Broca got his hands on it, it was at least a couple hundred years old, if not more than 1,000 years old.
Yeah, can you imagine the feather in your cap? You're just sitting around with your other cohorts, and you're like, I have a part of the brain named after me, by the way, so I don't know what you guys have done. But
I know. They're like, Paul, you end every argument with that.
Hi, I'm Paul Broca of Broca's Area. He's how he introduced right. himself.
It says it on his card, too. Paul Broca, comma, Broca's Area.
He was obviously like, well, this is an interesting thing, because what he was looking at was a piece of a human skull where a piece of it had been purposefully cut away and removed remarkably well. And it actually started to grow back, which indicates that whoever had this performed on them, that means they survived and was trying to heal.
Yeah.
At least for a little while.
Yeah. Like, it takes a little time for the bone to heal around like a skull cut away. So, yeah, they had to have lived. I think in some cases I've seen when the skull starts growing back, it indicates at least a year of survival. So,
oh, wow. Okay. So, yeah. I was going to ask that.
So I only saw that one or two places. I didn't see exactly, like, I don't know 100%, but it seems like it's a little while, right? It's not like a day or two, right?
Yeah.
So the thing is like, Broca's sitting here saying, like, okay, this is evidence of, this is a purposeful medical procedure. I believe that this person had their brain cut into to treat some form of malady or something like that. It's a proto-brain surgery, basically. And it was called trepanation. And Paul Broca went to the French Anthropological Society, I think, which he founded.
Yeah.
That was another thing he did. He was the founder of the Anthropological Society. Yeah, and they still were like, no, you got this one wrong, Paul.
Yeah.
But he went to them and said as much, and they're like, no, that's just not possible. And here's the thing that stuck out to me, Chuck. It wasn't that they were saying it's not possible that somebody could cut into someone else's head. Because these people, these members of the Anthropological Society, or just people in general in France in the 1870s, were well aware of that procedure. It had a name, trepanation. And you could go to the hospital and get trepanned depending on what kind of problem you had with your head. So it's not like they were just totally unfamiliar with this. They were super familiar with it. What they refused to believe is that some other society, a non-European society, especially one removed in time, was capable of performing the surgery and in performing it in a good enough way that the person could possibly survive it.
Yeah. I mean, they were like, I just don't know. That sounds like they certainly weren't performing medical procedures. The Incas weren't doing that.
Right.
And he was like, I don't know. Look at that hole.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's pretty purposeful to me.
Yeah. And so what Broca figured out was he was the first one to really stumble upon this evidence that this medical procedure that they were carrying out in the hospitals, trepanation, was part of like a really ancient medical procedure, virtually unchanged in a lot of ways. Like, yeah, the tools that they used were kind of changed and kind of updated, but basically the procedure they were carrying out in the hospitals of France in the 1870s and elsewhere in Europe and America was basically the same thing that people were doing thousands of years ago and had been doing for thousands of years as well.
Yeah, I mean, they were doing it so much in Europe in the 18th century. It was known as the, is it trepan or trepan?
I say trepan.
Trepan, the trepan century, or because it's us, we'll call it the golden age of trepanation. Although now I'm doubting myself. It seems like the golden age might have been, you know, 1,000 years ago.
Yeah, I think you might be right about that, too.
But it started out as a veterinary practice, and we'll get a little bit to we'll get to the famous cow later on.
Right.
The ancient cow.
But in the 18th century, they think that it started out as a veterinary practice.
Correct. And then we'll get to the ancient cow a bit later.
Right.
But It extended humans after the veterinary procedures. And, you know, doctors at the time were like, you know, we think it's useful. We think it helps out with certain things that we'll get to as well. But they said it's also killing a lot of people. And it's got a survival rate of about 10%. And here's the little, like, whopper of a detail here. Uh-huh. The survival rate in ancient times was really, really high.
Yeah. Like, it made the modern survival rate just look embarrassingly low.
It was flip-flopped, really, wasn't it?
Yes. And that golden age, like you were mentioning, it seems like the golden age of trepanation occurred thousands of years before modern medicine ever came around. And that when modern medicine came around and kind of took over trepanation, it really dropped the ball, kind of.
Well, yeah. And then, you know, of course, once he finds that one skull, other skulls start coming forward. They start walking forward and saying, hey, check me out. I'm out here as evidence as well, which was pretty remarkable.
That's like, have you ever seen that Mystery Science Theater 3000 episode on the screaming skull?
No.
It's like the villain in the movie is like a skull that can move around and fly at people, kind of like the bunny from Monty Python and the Holy Grail, but it's a skull version of that.
They found, or we now know, that the oldest trepan skull comes all the way back from about 8,000 years ago in the Stone Age during the Mesolithic. Mm-hmm. Sorry.
I take back my first. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
And that was 8,000 years ago. And like, this is the beginnings of sort of planting things and eating vegetables and like building cities, like the very beginnings of civilization, basically.
Yeah. And we're like cutting holes into one another's heads. And we found evidence of this stuff like all over the world. This wasn't just like one weirdo city doing this. Like, this was everywhere in places that were really removed from one another. Like, there's evidence of ancient trepanation among indigenous peoples in Canada and North America. There's the same thing in Ukraine, North Africa, Portugal, everywhere. The Scandinavia, the Iraq, all over the place. There's evidence of trepan skulls that turn up. South America is another one. And so it just kind of goes to show you, either it was something that evolved independently in all these places, or it's so ancient that it originated somewhere and then managed to spread out as people spread across the globe, which is pretty interesting either way.
Yeah, and it got like really popular. This stat really got me. During the Copper Age, which was just after Stone Age, they found that about 5 to 10% of all skulls that they found from the Neolithic area were trepanned.
Yeah, not just up to 10% of all the skulls that have ever turned up had holes cut into their skull. And the thing is like we were saying, like if that had just been it, if that were the sum total of it, that, you know, wow, that's really interesting. People used to cut holes in their skulls, and that was it. It would still be worth remarking on, you know, or talking about. Probably would have just stayed at the internet roundup. But the reason that it's worth a whole episode is because of that survival rate, that not only do they cut skulls in each other's heads with rocks, actual rocks, the people survived these operations and may have actually been improved as a result of these operations, and that it had been going on for thousands of years and still kind of continues today. That's what really makes the whole thing noteworthy. And when you look back at trepanation in like the Mesolithic and Neolithic era, like that's part of medical history. It's not just some weird thing that people used to do in other cultures. Like, that was the beginning of a surgery that we still carry out today. I don't think we can get that across enough.
Yeah, there's a neuroscientist named Charles G. Gross that put the estimate of survival sometimes up to 90%, 50 to 90%.
Yeah.
And then a survey of skulls from the Iberian Peninsula, 75% showed evidence that they had healed, or at least were healing at that site, which means they lived for a while. Like you said, skull just doesn't grow overnight. It takes a little while.
Yeah.
And as long as that blood's flowing, I guess it's healing. And then that actually dropped. So like I said, that's flip-flopped from success rates, you know, thousands and thousands of years later in Europe.
Right.
And then when the Holy Roman Empire was doing this in medieval Europe, they weren't doing it as good. They had a higher mortality rate. And the thinking is because they used knives and then like wiped them off and the knives got really dirty. Whereas in the olden days, they would fashion like brand new tools out of bone and rock and stuff. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they were, I guess, comparatively pretty sanitary.
Yeah, because if you nap, you know, cut off the face of a rock to create a new stone tool to perform a trepanation, that rock hasn't been exposed to anything. It's basically sterile now because you just cut off the face and now you're using it. Whereas if you're performing surgery using the same tools and all you're doing is washing it off, like, that's just bacteria city. And it's not that hard to get a brain infection when you cut into a skull reusing tools that have just been kind of washed off with water a little bit. So yeah, that was probably a really good reason why the survival rate went down. But one of the reasons why it was so high also earlier is because people, like, even back in the Mesolithic and Neolithic, seem to have understood a couple of things. And one was you stay away from the dura mater, which is that really hard, tough, not hard, but really tough membrane that encases the brain and the spinal cord and protects it from the outside, even if your skull cracks open. As long as you stay away from that and don't cut into that, your chances of survival are pretty high. And ancient people seem to have really understood this. They also knew to stay away from sutures, which is where your skull, the pieces of your skull, which are not fused together when you're born, they fuse as you grow older. The places, the lines where your skull plates form together, those are called sutures, and they also need to stay away from those as well. So apparently if you just do those few things and create a new stone tool every time you perform the surgery, your survival rate's going to go through the roof.
Yeah, and you know, before we get called out, maybe we shouldn't refer to those stone tools as sterile. Maybe we should just say, like, pretty clean for the time.
Clean enough. How about that?
Clean enough for rock and roll.
Yeah, that's right.
All right. I guess we should take a break. Great setup.
Yeah, I thought so too, man.
And we'll come back and try and answer the big question after this, which is, why the heck were they doing this? Hey everybody, Chuck here. Are you thirsty? Well, before you take a sip, have you stopped to think about what's in your water? Many conventional bottled waters contain PFAS, harmful substances known as forever chemicals.
Yeah, but you can drink water as clean as nature intended with Richard's Rainwater.
That's right. Richard's Rainwater collects 100% pure, refreshing drops of rain. Yes, it really is rain. Richard's Rainwater is caught clean before it hits the ground or becomes polluted with pesticides and contaminants that are commonly found in groundwater.
And since rain is naturally pure, there's no need for harsh chemicals or additives. That means Richard's Rainwater contains no added fluoride, no chlorine, no forever chemicals, no microplastics, no nothing. Just pure drops of rain.
That's right. Enjoy the smooth, clean taste of Richard's still rainwater and the long-lasting cold pressured bubbles of Richard's sparkling rainwater, perfect for sipping or mixing into your favorite cocktail. Just visit richardsrainwater.com to find a retailer near you. Enjoy pure, refreshing rainwater. Sip the sky.
Hey everybody, we're here to tell you about Viator, a tool that you can use to plan and book travel experiences around the world.
That's right. The Viator app and website make it easy to explore 300,000 plus travel experiences so you can discover what's out there no matter where you're traveling or what you're interested in.
Yep, Viator can help you plan better travel experiences. 300,000 plus travel experiences to choose from means you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy.
That's right. You can also enjoy real traveler reviews to get insider information from people who've already been on the experience that you're considering. Plus, you get free cancellation that helps you plan for the unexpected.
Yeah, and Viator offers 24/7 customer service, so you know you'll get support at any hour if things aren't going as planned. So download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find the perfect travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator. And now a word from the show's sponsors at Betterment. Let's talk about hustle culture, shall we? You know, the whole rise and grind, go big or go home thing? It's a lifestyle that might not be for you.
That's right, but one that your money can handle thanks to Betterment. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle.
How? Good question. Their automated technology optimizes your investments again and again. With Betterment, your money is taking ice baths at 5 a.m. while you get your well-deserved rest. Your money downs protein smoothies and automatically reinvests your dividends, all before you head out the door. Your money is a workaholic.
But you don't have to be, because you've got Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. So visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed. Hey, everybody. It's halftime and the scoreboard is not looking good. You're feeling low and not sure you can pull out a win. And that's when you have to dig deep, lift your head up, and say to yourself, time to get back in the game. Pull off some bank heists and take as much of your friend's money as you possibly can.
That's right. The smash hit mobile game Monopoly Go lets you compete with your friends to get the most riches and the biggest empire. It's the Monopoly you love, but on your phone, anytime, with tons of new twists, including leaderboards to compare your progress to your buddies.
That's right. You can play on countless dynamic Monopoly boards. You can make your friends bankrupt by smashing their landmarks with a wrecking ball, and you can charge other players rent for your iconic properties.
Plus, you can even work with your friends to crack open community chests in tournaments to get rewards and climb the leaderboard.
So get back out there, put on your game face, and download Monopoly Go, now free on the App Store or Google Play. All right. So they know this was happening. They know it was working pretty well and that people were surviving at remarkable rates. Mm-hmm. But the big sort of $54,000 question that they had then and that we're still trying to kind of figure out, and we don't know for sure, is like, why would they do this to begin with? Why would they dig into a person's head and cut out a piece of their skull 8,000 years ago? And, you know, we've got some decent ideas that all make sense to me.
Yeah, the whole problem is kind of like you have to put yourself in the mentality and the shoes and the worldview of somebody who was...
They had no shoes.
Right, exactly. There's a huge difference
the
right there.
The bare feet of Tuk-Tuk.
People who are still humans, they were modern humans in every sense of the word, aside from not living in the modern era. But they didn't have the benefit of, you know, a general knowledge of medicine that just about every human alive has today, just from living in the 21st century.
Right. Or
just kind of having read about something on the internet. You know, like, there's just so many pieces of the way we see the world that we take for granted, because there's just so many ways that we absorb information, and there's so much information available to us that wasn't before, that to kind of remove yourself from that and put yourself in the position of somebody 6,000 years ago and to understand what they were thinking when they were cutting into someone's head that drove that purpose, it's really tough to do. But yeah, like you were saying, there's some researchers have come up with some pretty good ideas, general ideas, broad categories that you could probably put just about anything into. And there's actually three researchers that are worth shouting out. There was Lopez, Caro, and Pardiñas, three Spanish researchers who wrote a 2011 paper that was one of the better recent comprehensive looks at trepanation, ancient trepanation.
Yeah, so one of the reasons, and like you said, I don't think it's lazy, but you could kind of slap these reasons on anything that happened back then.
Yeah.
One of them was magic or religious, like, you know, free the demons from someone's head. I kind of read that as possibly to help cure mental illness, which they were definitely doing in Europe thousands of years later.
Yeah.
So I don't see why they wouldn't have maybe done the same thing. But I mean, it's remarkable, though, to think that 8,000 years ago that they knew enough or were guessing enough to know that there is even a brain in there that was really important to the human body,
that
you know?
Was calling the shots, yeah. Yeah, I mean—
Like, how they even know that?
I don't know. And similarly, that whole idea that, like, the third eye— That part that kind of connects you to the metaphysical world, was located somewhere, you know, in the front of your head, which I think is actually right where the pineal gland was, which was later associated with that too. That kind of falls into that same tranche as well, the magic religious, which is to kind of open yourself to a greater plane of spirituality. Like they think that dimensions or in some cultures, like shaman or medicine people or the high priests, whoever were kind of responsible for that, would possibly be trepanned to kind of connect to that different level, that other way of thinking.
Yeah, another one, and this is definitely one that you could probably say explains away a lot of things, is some sort of initiation rite. Child passing into adulthood at, you know, the age of 7, or if you want to turn someone into a great warrior, maybe before some big battle, hopefully just a little bit before that big battle, you know, just to give them a chance to heal up.
Yeah.
But that, you know, that makes sense. They did all kinds of things back then for rites of passage. So why not this?
There's also, those to me are the ones that are the hardest to grasp. I think even harder than magic religious, the ones for initiations, not grasp, I mean to pin down definitively, to say, yes, this is exactly what was going on here. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and then follow, like, real legit medical purposes. Like, if Tuk-Tuk had epilepsy or something, or chronic migraine headaches, any weird changes in behavior or convulsions or anything like that, they maybe tumors, as a literal way to maybe relieve like brain swelling or pressure on the brain, which is, I mean, if that's real, then that's remarkable, because that is very much a medical procedure that they still do today, craniotomies.
Right. And then kind of tied into that is a treatment of trauma, specifically head wounds. And there's an anthropologist who specializes in, I think, maybe the Inca. His name's John Rizzo, and he thinks that the Inca, and the Inca went on to become prolific trepanners. I think maybe half of all of the trepan skulls that have been discovered came from the Inca. They were big time into trepanning. But he thinks that their trepanation may have started when somebody was picking bone out of a head wound to, like, clean it or treat it. Mm-hmm. And that person went on to survive, and they thought, well, okay, maybe this is a thing. Maybe, like, you want a hole in your head, or if you have a hole in your head, it's supposed to be a little more cleaner than, you know, just bone sticking out. And that, you know, you can. It's not hard to make the leap to, okay, we're actually going to carve a hole in your head to maybe treat something else that is associated with the head to us. That's not really a big stretch, to tell you the truth. I definitely buy into it.
Yeah, the one I didn't see, which I think is sort of plausible, is just like ancient curiosity.
Sure, what happens when I carve a hole in my friend's head?
Sure, or what's in that thing? What is in this round thing that has this very hard protective covering? Like, maybe something important is in there that we should take a peek at.
I wonder, because I know that there's, like, a mechanism among people against self-harm.
Right.
And I feel like there's a mechanism against harm as well. I don't know how,
like,
old
it is. Like, just letting someone do that?
Yeah, or harming somebody, like, doing that to somebody else. You know what I mean? Like, there's just, it's almost like there's some innate sense of, like, you shouldn't crack open a head, someone's or yourselves, or your own. And that there's, like, some innate instinct against it. And I would guess it's older than 10,000 years old, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, you made a great point, and you put this one together yourself, that even if it was to, like, because there was a head injury or something like that, that's a big difference. Like, treating a wound with some sort of surgical procedure is way, way different than that being the surgical procedure to begin with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's there. That's where it's, like, murky. That's where it's like, okay, you're really kind of making some assumptions and leaps here when you put yourself in that person's position and try to say, this is why they were doing it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, like the medical thing to reduce influence, like maybe they did have some really vague understanding of what swelling was in on other parts of the body, and maybe it just made sense. I don't know. I think it might be an overlapping of all these reasons. And also, like, hey, we did this for this thing, so why not try it for this thing? That kind of deal.
Yeah, and, you know, I think, like, I get what you're saying with the curiosity, but I think tied into that is observation too. Like somebody falls down and hits their head on a rock, or they're attacked by some other group and gets hit on the head with a rock.
And they see brain?
People, yeah, and people, like right. The other people around, like watch what happens just out of natural curiosity, mm-hmm. and they learn from that. So I feel like it was probably a series of accidents and that knowledge was gleaned from that kind of got passed along and then developed into an actual procedure, you know?
Yeah, and then, you know, there are other cases where they may not fall into any of these categories. I think people in modern-day Hungary during the Neolithic, they did this after death mm-hmm. as a funeral rite, which I guess that could fall into magic religious reasons.
Sure.
Or rite of passage even.
Especially if you believe that there's some part of the body that survives after death that maybe needs to escape or whatever. I could see trepanning a skull to let that out to go on to the afterlife. Again, I'm well aware I'm falling victim to the very thing I was warning about, that I'm just totally putting myself into their shoes and answering for them. Like, I'm not a professional anthropologist, just an intense hobbyist, you know?
And what was the deal with the Russians that were trepanning where the man bun sits?
Yeah, so that's at the Obelian, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is a really risky place to trepan because that's where the blood supply to your head collects. Like where I saw it described, I think, on the BBC, is where a high ponytail would be gathered.
That's where the man bun.
Yeah. That's where the blood that's going to be distributed throughout your brain first collects and gathers. So it's really risky to cut in there. And I think something like 1% or less of all the trepan skulls ever found show a trepanation site there. And yet there's a number of Chalcolithic, Copper Age skulls that have been found that are endemic to Russia only, that have the trepanation at that site, and they seem to have been healthy, and most of them seem to have healed. So they're like, we're pretty sure this is some sort of ritual,
yeah.
Maybe an initiation. I could see that being like a warrior thing or like a, you know, priestly class kind of thing.
Early KGB.
Yeah, probably. They stuck some sort of proto-microchip in there to keep an eye on everybody.
So I mentioned the famous cow. Like we mentioned, it was a purposeful veterinary procedure in Europe in what they call the golden age of trepanation mm-hmm. In the 18th century. But they found a cow skull from about 5,000 to 6,000 years ago in France. That was the first sign of trepanation on an animal. And this was another one where it was like, it was clear that it was very purposeful. It wasn't a fracture. It wasn't a cow fight or a cow scrap. There wasn't a tumor or at least no signs of anything like that. Mm-hmm. But they did find a very purposeful trepanation. And it could have been, it's either way, it's cool. It could have been them practicing on an animal before they did it on humans, which shows pretty decent amount of sophistication medically, mm-hmm. Or it's just early veterinary medicine, which is also remarkable.
Yeah, and either way, it's, as far as we know, the earliest example of either one of those. So, yeah. It's a cow skull worth hanging on to if it ever comes into your possession.
So, hang it over the door, put it on your front bumper.
But, I mean, it's a special one because it's got a hole, like, right in the front. I've seen a picture of it. It's pretty cool.
That's
looking.
Right.
So once we enter history, things become a lot clearer because by definition, everybody wrote stuff down. That's when you enter history, right? It's recorded. And the ancient Greeks continued trepanning. And I would guess, Chuck, that the reasons and the procedures that the ancient Greeks were performing as far as trepanation goes mm-hmm. closely resembled stuff that the reasons and the procedures from prehistory as well.
Yeah, like you said, once they started writing stuff down, we could read it in the Hippocratic Corpus, which was a collection of ancient Greek medical texts mm-hmm. From the teachings of Hippocrates, obviously. Mm-hmm. They talk about therapeutic reasonings behind it, some of the ones that we already talked about, basically, including something called Places in Man, which is one of the texts in there. And it recommended trepanation for the prevention of probably swelling because of skull fractures.
And swelling, and then they were also preventing infection of that dura mater. that membrane that encases the brain. And they were saying, basically, if you have a fracture, especially a fracture along one of the sutures, you want to actually trepan and open up a bigger hole because pus can get into the fracture, that suture, and it can't get back out. And it's going to infect the dura mater and the brain and have all cause all sorts of problems. So you want to open up a larger hole to let some of that pus out and clean some of the pus out. And that's pretty sophisticated. That's brain surgery they're describing right there. And, you know, Hippocrates was in the third or fourth century BCE. So, like, if they understood this by this time, keep pus out of the dura mater, you know, what did they understand 1,000 years before, 500 years before? They just weren't writing it down, but they still had that knowledge. You know what I'm saying? That's my guess.
Yeah, I'm going to go ahead and throw in, and this is so official it can go on the Wikipedia page. I'm going with pus as my worst word.
Worse than moist.
Oh, pus is way, way worse.
What about really moist
pus? A turkey can be moist, but a turkey with pus.
That's true.
You know?
A turkey could be moist with pus.
Oh, man. I can't take that word.
It's pretty bad.
It's the worst.
Especially
it's the worst
for
one.
A three-letter word. Usually three-letter. It's not packing a big punch. You need four or five.
Is it just three letters?
Yeah, P-U-S.
Never mind. mentioning earlier that mental illness, like, you know, releasing the demons or something could have been a reason thousands of years ago.
Yeah.
And that they also did that in medieval Europe. There was something called the Stone of Madness, where they believed that was an actual, like, stone inside your head, like a foreign, literal foreign object that caused people to go crazy. And there are even painters, specifically Hieronymus Bosch and others, who depicted this surgery removing the Stone of Madness.
Yeah. Have you seen that painting? It's a pretty famous one.
Yeah. It's pretty great.
Yeah.
I mean, I wouldn't want it on my wall, but.
And yeah, so it's almost like understanding of, you wouldn't want it next to your frame poster of the guy melting with stoned again written underneath it.
And then that's right next to the kitten that's going to hang in there.
Hang in there, baby. it's worth pointing out again that by the time the medieval era and even the Renaissance came around, we had gotten really bad at trepanation as far as survival rates go, and our reasons for it possibly had degraded as well, you know?
Yeah, and just real quickly, my favorite part of that painting is the funnel on the surgeon's head.
Yeah, well, I was reading about that, and I read
what's the deal?
So if you notice also, there's a nun seated at the table where the man is being trepanned, and she's wearing a book on her head.
And yeah, that, I mean, maybe that was for balance practice at least.
Supposedly, Bosch was basically mocking the doctor and the nun for, like, basically taking them to task, suggesting they should know better, that a Stone of Madness was BS and that they shouldn't be inflicting this on this poor individual who wouldn't necessarily know better. Because I think he's depicted as a fool in it, so he wouldn't have any. No. The patient, the doctor and the nun should know better than to perform this kind of surgery on somebody because there is no Stone of Madness. That was the interpretation I read, which makes me like Bosch even more.
With the armadillo in his trousers.
Yeah, really.
Nice work there, Bosch.
Breeches. So you want to take a second break and come back and explain a little bit more about how this might happen?
Yeah.
Okay.
And how they even did it. Does that sound good?
Yeah, we'll be right back, everybody.
Hey everybody, Chuck here. Are you thirsty? Well, before you take a sip, have you stopped to think about what's in your water? Many conventional bottled waters contain PFAS, harmful substances known as forever chemicals.
Yeah, but you can drink water as clean as nature intended with Richard's Rainwater.
That's right. Richard's Rainwater collects 100% pure, refreshing drops of rain. Yes. it really is rain. Richard's rainwater is caught clean before it hits the ground or becomes polluted with pesticides and contaminants that are commonly found in groundwater.
And since rain is naturally pure, there's no need for harsh chemicals or additives. That means Richard's rainwater contains no added fluoride, no chlorine, no forever chemicals, no microplastics, no nothing. Just pure drops of rain.
That's right. Enjoy the smooth, clean taste of Richard's still rainwater and the long-lasting cold pressured bubbles of Richard's sparkling rainwater, perfect for sipping or mixing into your favorite cocktail. Just visit richardsrainwater.com to find a retailer near you. Enjoy pure, refreshing rainwater. Sip the sky. Hey, everybody. It's halftime and the scoreboard is not looking good. You're feeling low and not sure you can pull out a win. And that's when you have to dig deep, lift your head up, and say to yourself, time to get back in the game. Pull off some bank heists and take as much of your friend's money as you possibly can.
That's right. The smash hit mobile game Monopoly Go lets you compete with your friends to get the most riches and the biggest empire. It's the Monopoly you love, but on your phone, anytime, with tons of new twists, including leaderboards to compare your progress to your buddies.
That's right. You can play on countless dynamic Monopoly boards. You can make your friends bankrupt by smashing their landmarks with a wrecking ball, and you can charge other players rent for your iconic properties.
Plus, you can even work with your friends to crack open community chests in tournaments to get rewards and climb the leaderboard.
So get back out there, put on your game face, and download Monopoly Go, now free on the App Store or Google Play.
All right, so our old pals Lopez, Caro, and Pardiñas, the Spanish researchers who wrote that 2011 paper, also kind of said, hey, we've got some general ways from what we can tell. There's some, like, three, maybe four I saw, but you can really lump them into three categories of how trepanation surgery was performed. And they are basically, they boil down to grooving, scraping, and boring and cutting. And if you just wiggle in your seat, that's the appropriate response to hearing about that.
Yeah, the first one I get, that makes sense to me. If I had a skull and primitive tools, the way that I would cut a hole in it would probably be to groove it. That is to take a hard stone, something really sharp that you probably even sharpened further, and carve, basically do little digging little half turns or full turns in a circle, you know, carving in till you can kind of just pop that thing off.
Yeah.
Or lift it off. You don't want to, there's nowhere to pop it into.
You know, one of those, yeah, you don't pop it into your brain.
Into your brain.
You know, one of those like apple cores that's like kind of like an open tube. It's like open in the middle.
Yeah.
And there is such a thing as an apple core, by the way. But if you took one of those and you put a handle, a crosswise handle on top to grip, that's that was kind of the tool that you would use for grooving. And there's actually the Romans had it, the Greeks had it. I think there's, I saw a picture of a 16th century trepanation kit that had one of those. It's a really ancient tool. But like you're saying, you could also do it with a stone. And I think grooving sounds pretty bad. Scraping, I think, would be worse.
Yeah. I didn't quite understand scraping. It sounded like grooving to me.
Oh, no. So,
but I'm no dancer.
Imagine that somebody has peeled back part of your scalp.
Yeah,
and
I'm
this
with
is,
you there.
This is worth pointing out. Like, cutting into your scalp is far and away the worst part. Once you do that, your skull and your brain, they don't have pain receptors.
Yeah.
So it's the scalp being cut back that actually really hurts and produces the most blood. So
sure.
Once you
like
have
they
that,
do brain surgery with you awake, like now.
Precisely, because you don't,
or they can.
You don't feel any pain because there's not pain receptors there. So once you have the scalp peeled back, what they do with scraping, or what they would do, is take a very sharp rock and then later on tools too, but they're basically taking advantage of the fact that your skull is curved and just making a straight motion, kind of like you would with like a wood. Is it a wood lathe? A wood rasp, something like that, where you're just scraping away little by little wood, but you're doing this instead with the skull until you finally wear a hole into the skull. That's the scraping technique.
Okay. I guess that sounds a little like grooving to me, but...
No, grooving is like taking a circular tube, putting it down on top of the skull and twisting it back and forth until you
I
like...
Get all that.
Yeah, yeah. It's different. It's definitely different. I'll show you.
All right.
I'll show you. We'll get a cow skull.
And then, boy, I have one, no problem.
Okay.
Boring and cutting. This one was not used much in Europe. I think this is more of a South American Arabic jam, mm-hmm. Also in Africa. This is when, and this is something that is sort of a carpentry trick. If you're ever carpentry trick, if you're caught without the right saw, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say you wanted to make a hole in a piece of wood and all you had was a drill. You would drill little holes in a circle and then, you know, as close together as you can.
Right.
And then from there, it's not too hard to kind of punch out the areas in between.
But instead, you're doing this with a skull.
That's right. And you don't have a drill. And this one, to me, would be the one that's the most rough around the edges, probably.
Right, yeah. They know that this is the technique used when they find a skull that has, like, a serrated opening.
And yeah.
Apparently the Inca were super fond of that one, right?
Sure. As I did this just last week, actually,
right.
But not in a skull. It's because I was stuck without a saw, and all I had was my drill, so I did that. And it works okay. You just got to have, like, some sandpaper or a file or something to kind of smooth it out.
Well, yeah, I saw, like, one of the ways that they thought they might have done the drill is by rolling the, you know, pointed, sharp, I guess, rock in between your two palms, you know, like you're trying to start a fire, which is actually something I saw that the ancient people would have known. You want to avoid heating the bone. Whatever technique you're using, you got to stop and, like, rest for a little while to prevent the bone from heating up, because you don't want to transfer that heat. You don't want to start a fire inside the skull. Which is essentially what you could all also be doing if you're not careful with letting the friction, the heat produced by the friction, to cool off in between little sessions.
Yeah, it's funny that this came up now because, you know, I mentioned a couple of times watching that survival show on History Channel Alone,
mm-hmm.
where you can bring like 10 things and then they throw you out in the woods. There's a new spinoff series now called Alone Beast, where it's only 30 days, but you take nothing but the clothes on your back. So the people that are dropped here are literally fashioning stone tools and stuff, and it's kind of cool to watch.
That's cool. At least they have clothes on.
They have clothes, and that's it. I guess the next step would be naked, and the beast thing comes in is that the only thing they give you is one large dead animal.
Oh, it's dead.
Like,
I'd be like,
in the bayou, it's an alligator. In the Arctic, it's like a boar. In the Arctic, it's like a moose or a buffalo or something.
I see, but it's not for companionship.
No. The animal is dead, and they're like, this is all you got, so you can, you know, use their bones. Like, an animal's jawbone is really useful because that's, like, super sharp,
uh-huh.
and a boar's tusk can be really sharp, so they make knives out of that stuff.
Gotcha.
And they use some of these carving and boring grooving techniques to break off bone to make, like, sharper things.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'll bet getting your hands on that first tusk or that first jawbone to get started is pretty messy.
Well, it is. And they have to get in these. I mean, it's kind of gruesome, especially if you're a vegetarian. But
yeah,
they have to get into these animals without a knife to begin with.
Right.
So they have to start with, like, a sharp a rock as they can get, basically, and go from there.
How ghastly. This is just
pretty ghastly.
Reality television now.
Well, I mean, sure.
<That's> crazy.
I guess so.
Wow. Next up is the Stone of Madness.
Well, I think it's kind of interesting because it's not like, ooh, look at some cool modern reality idea. It's like, well, let's take people back to the Stone Age and see how they could do.
No, I get that. I get that. That's,
you know?
That's cool. But you just know there's a coked up producer 15 feet right. away. You're really kind of dragging
yeah,
the whole thing
so.
Down as far as the Stone Age goes.
Yes, correct.
So you might be saying, Chuck, well, wait a minute. They're cutting into your head here. And yeah, maybe the bone doesn't hurt and the brain doesn't have pain receptors, but it's going to hurt to get to the skull. What are they doing here? And it depends on where you are. A lot of places supposedly just use restraint. Like, you were awake, you right. were not anesthetized. There were just a couple of dudes holding you down mm-hmm. while whoever was performing the trepanation performed the trepanation.
Yeah, that's rough. Another thing they would do, and to me, this is one of the better band names we've had in a while, they would use somniferous agents. And that's, you know, depends on where you are in the world and when it is. It could be cocoa extract, it could be poppy, it could be just getting them super drunk on wine. Mm-hmm. Just basically anything to kind of dull somebody out a little bit.
Yeah, and one of the places that just used restraint was among the Kisi, I think I'm saying that right, the Kisi people?
Yeah.
In Kenya, who were practicing this as recently as the mid-1960s, using basically the old traditions. And I think an anthropologist, I'm not 100% sure, E.L. Margetts went back 25 years later, a decade or two ago, and reported that they're still doing the trepanation surgery, but now they're using like local anesthetic and some other stuff.
Right.
But this is still performed in some places. And for that reason, there's like a group of people in the Western world, on the internet even, who basically say, like, hey, you know what the Kisi people are doing in Kenya? Like, that's part of a really ancient tradition, and we are here for it. And there's a trepanation, basically appreciation society that has developed pre-internet but really took off when the internet came around.
Yeah, and there are people, and I know this is what we talked about at some point because I remember self-trepanation.
Yeah, I kind of do too now.
And talking about that, but there was an artist name and a lobbyist named Amanda Fielding, Countess of Wemyss and March, mm-hmm. whatever that means. And in the
19th,
is that what that is?
Yeah, she's royalty. She's a minor royalty, but
oh, that's
Habsburg
for real. I thought
lineage.
It was just something she made up.
No, I think she's actual royalty.
All right. Well, in 1970, she performed an act of self-trepanation. A couple of years after that, a man named Peter Halverson did it.
Peter,
what'd I say?
Peter.
Why am I sticking V's in there?
Leave it to Peter.
What is going on with me?
Can you just see Peter Halverson listening to this and he's like, oh, they mentioned Amanda Fielding. I know I'm next. I know
right,
I'm next. And
comes.
Then you hit him with the Peter and he's like, Peter, man.
I'm so sorry, Pete. Very sorry. And then there's a guy named Bart. You know what the real problem is? I have a light off in here and I can't see as well.
Oh, I would say that might have something to do with it.
Yeah. Bart Hugis?
Well, he's Dutch, so I'll bet we would say Bart Hugis.
Sure. Oh, really?
Hugis.
It's probably that. He is a former med student, and he got really into this. In 1962, he had he wrote something called Large Mechanism of Brain Blood Volume.
All one word. Yeah.
And he said that, you know what, a person's level of consciousness really depends on how much blood is flowing to the brain. Maybe there's something to that. Mm-hmm. And he said it falls as we get older. And so maybe what we should do is trepan ourselves, basically, and open up our creativity.
Yeah, his whole point was that if you look at kids are way more creative, they're way more free, they enjoy life more, and it just so happens that their skulls haven't fully fused. So his whole thing was, if you are an adult, your skull's fused, for the most part, you have a fused skull. Some very lucky people don't ever have their skull fused, according to Bart Hughes. And he actually apparently talked John Lennon out of self-trepanation or being trepanned because he said, you probably wouldn't notice a difference because I suspect that your skull isn't fully fused. You're a very creative person.
Yeah, I don't know about that. But is that real?
Yeah. But then John Lennon went to recommend trepanning to Paul McCartney, who said, nah, I'm not going to do that. But
really?
This guy,
yeah. You should cut a hole in your head.
This guy was like a guru of trepanation and ended up like creating this following, including Amanda Fielding and Peter Halverson. And they went on to basically carry on this guy's vision. Halverson formed the International Trepanation Advocacy Group. Fielding runs the Beckley Foundation. And both of them help people get trepanation surgery, I think, from this one surgeon down in Mexico. And they all believe that it's like this basically shortcut to psychedelic existence and opening up the third eye and becoming a more spiritual, happier person.
There you go. Yeah.
And so, you know, Western researchers are like, no, this goes against science. This doesn't make sense. Like, yes, if you have a problem in your brain, if there's like, if you have inflammation, opening up your brain will help with blood flow. We know that. We perform that surgery. It's trepanation. We call it craniotomy, but we do it. But if you're healthy and you don't have inflammation in your brain and everything's just normal, this is not going to help you. And the internet said, I can't hear you. All I heard was what these other people said. And it kind of took off on the internet to some extent. I don't want to say it's like huge, but it's still got some sort of traction and following on online, I believe.
Well, it took off so much that the British Medical Journal felt the need to say, hey, medical establishment, be on the lookout for this. If someone shows up that has drilled their head, at least you know what's going on.
Yeah, and all the trepanation people were like, yeah, establishment.
Yeah, exactly. My freedoms.
So, yeah, that's out there. It's a thing, and it's probably not helpful at all. So it's not going to cure depression or anxiety or anything like that, which is some of the things it touts. So be careful out there, everybody. Meaning,
yes.
To wit, don't trepan yourself or have somebody else trepan you, okay?
No, the only grooving you should be doing is on that wooden floor.
Yeah, I love it when we're grooving together.
Very nice.
You got anything else?
I got nothing else.
Well, I don't either, so that means that this episode of Trepanation has... Oh, yeah, I keep trying to end everything like a short stuff. Let me do it differently, everybody. If you want to know more about Trepanation, go read up on Trepanation. It's pretty interesting stuff. And since I said that, it's time for listener mail.
I'm going to call this Josh Made Me Quit Vaping.
Oh, I saw this one. I was so proud.
It's great. Hi, guys. Never thought I'd have a reason to email, but now I do. Wanted to say thank you for essentially making me want to quit vaping. I was listening to your child labor episode and got to the part where Josh said he'd been smoking, started smoking in his young teens and then quit in his adult years. I only started using a vape 1 year ago and hadn't really considered quitting anytime soon. I just kept telling myself I would get around to it. You guys made me get around to it. I paused the episode. Wow. Threw the vape away.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm 1 week off of it.
Man, that's awesome.
As a goal, I told myself I couldn't listen to the rest of the podcast until September 1st. Wow, I love this. And could only listen if I avoided vaping. So far, I've had no urge to go back. Thank you guys for helping me get a jump on quitting early on. I believe you saved me from some unnecessary future misery.
Mm-hmm.
I appreciate everything you guys do. And that is from Tim.
That's awesome, Tim. I was so glad to hear that. I haven't written him back quite yet, but he's in my inbox.
Well, I'm going to tell him he made listener mail. So hopefully Tim will be like, won't be like, I started vaping again.
Right. No, don't do that. Congratulations, Tim. I really do think that was a very good move. And if you want to be like Tim, then you just throw your vape away too. Throw your pack of cigarettes away and get started. It's like Bob Hope always said, journey of 1,000 miles begins with one step.
That's right.
And that was from Tim, of course. So if you want to write to us like Tim did, you can send us an email, everybody. StuffPodcast@iHeartRadio.com.
Stuff You Should Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Hey, everybody, are you thirsty? Well, sip on pure, refreshing Richard's Rainwater. Yes, it's really rain. Caught clean before it hits the ground. Rain is naturally pure, so there's no need for harsh chemicals or additives. Richard's Rainwater contains no chlorine, no forever chemicals, no microplastics, no nothing. Enjoy the smooth, clean taste of Richard's still rainwater or the long-lasting and cold-pressured bubbles of Richard's sparkling rainwater. Visit richardsrainwater.com to find a retailer near you. That's richardsrainwater.com. Sip the sky.
There's two kinds of people in the world, people who love Health Aid kombucha and people who have never tried it. The bubbly mix of probiotic tea and refreshing juice is delicious and good for your gut health with great flavors to choose from that you can't help but love. If you've never tried it before, maybe try a bottle or can of passion fruit tangerine or ginger lemon. Your taste buds and your gut will thank you. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid kombucha today.
Health Aid kombucha.
The wait is almost over. Get ready for the 2024 NFL season as the full schedule is announced. Bring it! Every rivalry, every rematch, every rookie debut, every game revealed. The 2024 NFL schedule release, presented by Verizon, coming in May. Live on NFL Network, ESPN2, and streaming on NFL Plus. Terms and conditions apply to NFL Plus. Visit NFL.com/schedule release to learn more.
Set sail and save right away when you book your next Disney cruise vacation with UndercoverTourist.com. Undercover Tourist is your secret for savings on all Disney Resorts vacations. And now, fun in the sun with Disney Cruise Lines. How about enchanting entertainment or an exclusive visit to Castaway Key? Anything's possible aboard a Disney cruise vacation. Book now with UndercoverTourist.com, an authorized seller, and get a free in-room decor package with your Disney Cruise Line booking. Plus, exclusive savings at checkout. UndercoverTourist.com.